Actually, let me start by asking, are there any questions? A question.
We have four-dimensional gravity. Is it a three-dimensional like planar orbit, or is it a two-dimensional planar orbit that you'll get from just like a central potential?
Oh, you mean, okay, you're in 4 plus 1.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
4 plus 1, yeah. And then what are the orbits like? Well, you were invited,
We thought about it a lot. I mean, we can continue investigating if you don't want to give it away. But
wait, can you tell me why the following solution isn't obvious? Because I'm sure you thought about it and figured out what's wrong. So, okay. You have like a point, right? And the center of the potential. And then the only other initial value in the problem is like a single vector, right? Which is your initial velocity.
Yes. Okay.
So these three things define a plane and like a two-plane. And the problem, the whole problem is reflection symmetric over that two-plane. So like, does that mean the orbit has to remain in that two-plane?
In four dimensions? Is your initial velocity in four dimensions or three dimensions?
Your initial velocity is in four dimensions. Don't matter. It's always a single vector.
Okay.
So can I suggest that that kind of question is something maybe we can discuss over lunch, which
right.
I can stay for today. That you might have beautiful symmetry arguments like that, but you can also just do the more pedestrian thing that I was doing, which was look at the equations of motion. The extra complication may be that you have to think about, well, how do I set up something like spherical polar coordinates when I've got extra dimensions?
We just don't want to do all that.
I'm shocked and disappointed.
Well, you don't need polar coordinates, do you? All you need is
back to special relativity, which is the topic today. I wanted to continue the review, and we may even be able to finish, but we'll see how far we get. So we have started talking about Einstein's special relativity, which began with Einstein's postulates. There was the principle of relativity, that physics should look the same in all inertial frames, and the assumption that c, the speed of light, was going to be fixed in all inertial frames.
Okay. Sure.
One plus one dimensional world. The light rays can't curve, they can only travel in straight lines. So it seems like an accelerated observer. It seems like in a one plus one dimensional world, there's no way to tell whether you're accelerated.
See a frequency shift.
Let's save that one because I have the example at the end of the morning is discussing an accelerated observer. Yeah. So I don't think what you were saying was quite correct.
So, in Newtonian physics, I talked about lots of examples. You worked through some examples yesterday. And one of the key ideas that I talked about was changing coordinates. The examples you did yesterday did it in far more creative ways, but when we talked about a principle of relativity for classical mechanics, we talked about allowing for rotations, translations, and shifting by constant velocity. One of the ideas that comes out of that is the absolute labels that you assign to various events in the system or the positions isn't so important because I can just change those labels by doing one of these transformations. But what is important is the relative positions or the separations or displacements. So that's what's more important when I'm talking about physical processes. And Pythagoras tells us how those distances get measured in a Cartesian coordinate system. We just take a sum of the squares of the displacements in the various coordinate labels. And so this will, or this number will be invariant irrespective of when I just start doing these rotations or translations. Now, in special relativity, what we've done is we've added time to the game. Rather than talking about space alone, we're talking about space-time. And so, again, we want to talk about displacements or the separation of space-time events. But we'd like to come up with a similar measure, an invariant measure, that would be relevant for Minkowski space. So the question is, what is the relevant measure for And so you all know the answer, so I'll just ask you, what's the relevant measure when we're talking about Minkowski space? How do I fix up this rule for displacements in the Euclid or the Euclidean R3?
Which signature are we using?
Sorry? Well, we'll get the metrics. We're using a minus plus plus plus. That's the only possible signature. It would be a gross. well, it's interesting why there are two signatures, but we will always use in this course minus plus plus plus, which hints to the answer, which was that I fix it up. I have my delta x's. But then I fix up this rule by adding a contribution from delta t, but then the question was about the sign. The sign is negative. And one can examine these displacements or proper separations and how they transform, certainly under rotations. Again, that only involves this part of the measure, and so that's still invariant. But now you have the Lorentz transformations, which might mix t and various components, x, y, and z. And what you'll find is that that particular choice is left, or that this proper separation remain between two space-time events remains invariant under Lorentz transformations. Now, of course, I've got a minus sign here and a bunch of plus signs. And so the answer, even though I write delta s squared, the answer can be either positive, negative, or equal to zero. And so we have three kinds of separations. So there's delta s squared greater than 0. So those are the separations we're used to up here, where the x's dominate. And we'll call that space-like, a space-like separation. And a property of two space-time events that have a space-like separation is that I can always find a frame in which those two events are simultaneous or lie on a surface of constant t. Where delta t equals zero. Of course, the other choice is negative, so in that case, the t contribution is dominating, and so this is a time-like separation. Separation, and in the same way, we can always find a frame. Well,
fact, delta x equals 0, delta y equals 0, delta z equals 0. And then the other interesting case is in between, where they precisely vanish. And this is light-like or null. Separation. So in this case, well, by a rotation, I can always set delta x equals plus or minus c delta t. So the displacement in space is up to a factor of c equal to the displacement in time. So when we draw our space-time diagram, x, y, z, t. If I pick a point here, what's interesting is the dividing line, the set of nulls, the points that are null separated or light-like separated. So those define a cone where these lines run at 45 degrees. There's also a cone running backwards. Like that. And we would call this the future light cone of this particular point, the past light cone. And so all of the points inside the light cone here are time-like separated. The same is true in the past light cone, the difference being that these are all the points that an observer here can affect or reach. These are all the points that can affect the physics at that particular event, space-time point here. So any point, an observer at any point in the past light cone could reach this point here with an appropriate trajectory. And then everything outside, well, so everything outside that, outside the past or future light cone is going to be space-like separated from this point here. Well, I tried to distinguish in words the difference between the past and future or events inside the past and future light cones at a pragmatic or at a more formulaic level. What the future light cone has, or I can always find a frame where if I choose this frame where I have a delta t is always positive. Here the delta t is always negative. And so I'm never, well, even though I can do Lorentz transformations and mix the time and the space, I'm never going to be confused about positive or negative or future and past. I'll never be able to transform a point that lies in the past light cone to the future light cone. I'll always just be mixing up these points here or vectors or points in the past light cone. So well, there's a clear distinction between the past and the future in that diagram. So the next comment was just a comment about C, because this is something that happens fairly quickly in the book. So
When I started drawing the Minkowski space at the end of the last lecture, or when we write down the line element here, I always have C delta T, or here I had CT. What I said is that C is a natural conversion constant. It's a nifty constant that I stick in there, that so when I look at my diagram, all of the sets of axes are measured in the same units. X can be measured in centimeters or meters. T is naturally measured in something like seconds. But when I multiply by CT, it turns it into a distance. But we'll find that C and T always appear together in special relativity. And given, for instance, this measure, it's natural then to imagine that we're actually going to measure T and X in the same set of units. And so the net effect of that will be to take out the C's, or to set C equal to 1. The motivation, or to motivate that perhaps a little more, one can imagine in just our classical world, or in classical mechanics, that just by historical convention, perhaps, say, horizontal distances were always measured in centimeters. But vertical distances, up and down, is clearly different than sideways. So perhaps people decided to measure vertical distances in inches, say. And in that case, when I wrote down my invariant distances, I'd always have to include a conversion constant that converted the delta z's into appropriate units to match up with my horizontal displacements. But that's clearly an archaic way to do things, or it's a silly way to do things. It's clearly more convenient just to measure all of our horizontal or vertical displacements in the same set of units. And so it's the same idea here, that we'll just, from this point forward, always think that we can measure time in units of meters if we choose. If we want to get the units, or the standard units for time, back, it's just a matter of reinserting the factors of C into the game. So in special relativity, it's far more convenient X or Y or Z to be measured in the same units. And so to set our conversion constant, the book gets in the habit of taking or removing C from all of the formulas and simply thinking of C as equal to 1. So to convert back to conventional units, we're simply going to stick in 3 × 10⁸ meters, where C equals 3. So if I tell you that two events were time-like separated by a distance of 1 meter, and you wanted to know what that really meant in terms of a clock or a number of seconds, I'd simply stick in a factor of C, or in that case, divide by a factor of C to get the number of seconds between those two points. I have a habit of trying to carry the C's around just to make sure that I don't make mistakes, but we'll see how I do. I may give in to the book's notation and C's may start disappearing. But I've made my excuses, and you'll have to bear with that. Are there any questions about that point? Okay.
So this is a matter of simplifying the notation.
Something else then that simplifies the notation, again, we're not distinguishing between space and time. And so before we talked about displacement vectors, or we might talk about a velocity vector in classical mechanics, those were three-dimensional vectors. Now we're going to include time, and so it's natural to combine things together and produce vectors with four components. And so we introduce a four-vector notation. So basically, for instance, we gather up, well, how did I write this? I'm going to gather up all four labels for my space-time events as a four-component vector. So I might write in some notation x0, 1, 2, 3. But what I mean there is x0 is just this distance along the time axis, or it's the ct, and then 1, 2, and 3 are just the standard coordinate, Cartesian coordinates, x, y, and z. In the book, they'll use a shorthand where this, well, that vector is a boldface. That's hard for me to do on the board, and so I'll use a notation where a four vector comes with a squiggle underneath. So an x with a squiggle underneath means that's a four vector labeled x. So it has four components like this. Now, given this four vector notation, we can write, well, we can start working with it, and we can, for instance, write our Lorentz transformations in terms of matrices. So I would write x prime alpha is linearly related to the original x, and there's some matrix with indices alpha beta, like that. And again, I'm using a summation notation, so I'm summing over beta equals 0, 1, 2, 3. And in fact, to explicitly, if we compare with the Lorentz transformation that we wrote last day, for a Lorentz transformation, say along, I think we did along the x-axis, this is, has just some ones in the y and the z on the diagonal, because those are left invariant. And then here we have a gamma and a gamma for the t or the ct and the x directions on the diagonal, and then there's a minus gamma vc minus gamma vc, and well, okay, we can fill out the rest of this with zeros. So this is the four-vector notation to describe the Lorentz transformation that we had last day. We also had this interesting measure for displacements. So one might be, well, initially one might be tempted to write down using our summation notation, just something like that, delta x alpha, delta x alpha, and say that we're summing over those, that alpha index over all four values. But of course, this is wrong because it doesn't introduce the appropriate sign for the time component. And so what we have to do, as was alluded to, is that we have to introduce a metric in our Minkowski space or space-time. So what I'm going to do instead then is introduce an auxiliary object, eta alpha beta, delta x alpha, delta x beta. And so that's there to get that extra minus sign in there. So eta alpha beta. Is just a diagonal matrix with one, or a minus one rather, and then a bunch of zeros and a bunch of zeros. So right now, the only role of that eta alpha beta is to stick that minus one in there to make sure that we get the right measure or the right displacement between space-time points in Minkowski space. And again, well, yeah, I won't dwell on it. We're choosing minus plus plus plus. And to simplify this notation, though, I might, or well, we can introduce an inner product notation where I said that a squiggle gave me a four vector. And then I can think of this as the inner product between two four vectors. So the dot just indicates the only sensible or the standard inner product between four vectors, which indicates that I'm doing the summation with my metric in there. And you can start to see the utility of that. In a number of places. So an example is in electromagnetism, you might have an electromagnetic wave where I've got an E or a B that propagates along. So you might have, say, for instance, the sine of omega t minus k dot x in our conventional notation. So this is a wave propagating, well, in the k direction. But I can combine that together, or I can combine these together if I write a four vector that combines the frequency and the wave number or the wave vector. Like this, then I can just write this combination as minus k tilde x tilde. Similarly, what I know for an electromagnetic wave is that, well, that this is a, well, in fact, what I know is that omega squared equals c squared k squared, or in other words, what that means
is that, well, we will, well, if I use this inner product, another way of writing that is that this is a null four vector. And again, what this notation means is that I'm sticking an 8 alpha beta in there. And doing the two sums over 0 to 1, 2, 3. If we throw in a bit of quantum mechanics, and instead of talking about electromagnetic waves, if we talk about photons, Given the wave vector or the frequency and the wave vector, what I can do is I can assign to the photon an energy, which is h bar omega, and a momentum, which is h bar k. Again, I can bundle that all up in a four vector by just inventing a four momentum, which is h bar times the four wave vector. And so what that's going to be is this energy within, well, as long as we're carrying the C along, it's the energy divided by C. And in the spatial components, I get that momentum vector. And again, for a photon, because of this property, what I find is that E squared equals P squared, or that this four momentum is actually null. But I can generalize these ideas and the idea of a four momentum to think about massive particles. And in that case, I also get an equation. But on the other side of the equation, rather than zero, now I'm getting minus m squared C squared. And we'll talk about this more later. But one of the key ideas is that this is, or these equations are now invariant equations under the Lorentz transformations. And so different observers may assign different labels or different values to the different components in the four momentum. But they'll all agree, all of the observers will agree, that this equation for a photon is true, that the norm of the inner of the photon's four momentum is zero, or that it's a null vector, whereas for a massive particle, the norm is just a fixed constant. And we'll say later that that constant or fixed constant is just the well, it's just given by the rest mass of the particle. But So if the utility is that this is invariant, then I have to be able to transform these four vectors in the same way that I transform the x's. And so we arrive, we can write a generalized transformation. For any four vector, or any u alpha. And it's basically saying, as I go from one frame to the other, I just have to do this matrix multiplication, where that's the same lambda that we had before. The claim was that an equation like this, this norm in Minkowski space is invariant, i.e. that u prime dot u prime is equal to u dot u, or that the norm didn't change. If I write this out, what that's telling me is then on this side is just eta alpha beta u alpha u beta. On the left-hand side, I'm going to insert that equation, and so I have a delta gamma lambda delta alpha lambda gamma beta u alpha u beta. And so if I'm comparing these two equations, what that's saying is that this object is just eta alpha beta. And that, so that's saying that our metric is left unchanged by these Lorentz transformations. In fact, you can derive what the Lorentz transformations are by demanding that this metric stay invariant under a set of matrix transformations. And what you will find are the boosts of the Lorentz transformations that I talked about, and also the rotations, the things that just mix up the x or the spatial components of the four vectors. So, well, I can write it. So since that's I said that this was true for any somewhere any u alpha, then I have that equation eta alpha beta equals alpha gamma and it's easy to verify, or I'll leave it as an exercise. That we gave before. Having introduced the metric, though, and formulas like this, I just briefly wanted to return to the summation convention. So as we said, when I have a repeated index like the delta here,
But something that we can notice about all of these formulas that I'm writing is that, the correct formulas that I'm writing, is that in every pair that I write, when I have a repeated pair of indices, that one of the indices is a lower index and one of the indices is an upper index. So that's just part of this good housekeeping to keep track of our equations, that our refinement of the summation convention is in each pair. One index is raised, and one index is going to be lowered. And remember, what I said before is that when I label coordinates, I always have a raised index. That was a convenience before when we were talking about classical mechanics, and these were just the spatial components. But now it'll become, an essential part of the summation convention. Similarly, I introduced this notation for a four vector, U, where I put this squiggle underneath, but implicitly this means that I'm talking about an object U with a raised index alpha. So in all the examples that I wrote, where I wrote a squiggle like that, what I meant was X squiggle was that object, and then naturally the other squiggles or the boldface vectors that I was writing down carried the same kind of index. And if you like, with some reluctance, I'll write the words that those vectors or these objects where the with one index raised are known as contravariant vectors. And the reason they get a name is that they're distinguished from covariant vectors, which are just the objects with a lowered index. And what really distinguishes these two is the way they transform under the Lorentz transformations. What we would like is that we can build, what we said here is that we're going to do summations. And so what we would like is that an object like S alpha U alpha that's going to be invariant under our Lorentz transformations or under our boosts. And so given that we know that the transformation of U to U prime is just a matrix multiplication, this inner product or this summation is going to be invariant if S transforms, but it transforms with the inverse matrix. So if I simply define now that this transforms, again, by a matrix multiplication, for convenience, I wrote it with the lambda inverse on the other side. Then if I combine that with the transformations that we were doing before, when I transform this, S prime alpha U prime alpha
the U is going to give us a lambda alpha gamma U gamma. The S is going to give us an S delta lambda inverse delta alpha. But because this is just the inverse of that, this just becomes the identity delta gamma, but then I can get rid of it and this just becomes, say, gamma U gamma. So this inner product, or this kind of contraction of a covariant and a contravariant vector is then invariant as long as I have this transformation rule for the covariant vectors. And something else for the boosts, or for the Lorentz boosts that we had before, or, well, okay, beta, alpha. It's a simple exercise to check that all that happens so you can check that to get the inverse, well, the natural thing happens, this transformation looks almost the same as what I wrote before. The only difference is that the sign of these off-diagonal terms changed, i.e. the sign of the V changed. So it looks naturally like I'm boosting in the other direction. But again, this kind of, or this matrix, where I've written that inverse, is an object that's naturally transforming on these covariant vectors, in contrast with the original lambda, which transforms the contravariant. Another thing that you can check here is that I can get this object by simply manipulating the indices that we had before. So I can write this as, how am I writing it? Alpha, beta, which means that I have, so I want you to pay attention to the order of these indices. This is the lambda that I wrote before, but what I've done is I've produced, or I've written that with an index down and an index up, whereas before, the up and the down were reversed. And so I've raised and lowered indices, or implicitly what I'm writing there is eta alpha delta lambda delta gamma eta gamma. So I've rearranged the indices on this object by introducing etas in there. And you can check that if you do this multiplication, that the only thing that ends up happening is you change the sign of this off-diagonal term. Sorry?
Take 5 minutes after to do these simple things.
Okay, if people would like, we can.
I don't know, just this new notation, or even a lot. Are you going to use it for the rest of the lecture?
Well, why don't we?
Does anybody want?
Does anybody? Has everybody seen this before, or is this?
I think we can keep going.
Well,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah, these are relatively simple exercises. I think you can. Well, yeah. Why don't we keep going?
Yeah, everyone's okay. It's fine.
Well, I'll do, yeah, I'm going to do a few more, talk about matrices a little bit more, but then we can take a break, if people want to ask me, or we can do it for the board, or we can do it for the own satisfaction on that.
Okay.
The only other comment is here, I said that I was reluctant to write covariant and vector on the board, or contravariant and covariant. These are names that are well, technically they're used, but, you know, as a practical matter, you know, you can just remember that they're objects with raised indices and lowered indices. You know, you run into objects here that are objects with more than one index, and so you have to make up, one would have to make up more names. So it's simply, it's easier just to remember, or remember that you have to be careful. It matters whether the indices are raised or lowered, and implicitly that means different things. In particular, the transformations
under Lorentz boosts or rotations are slightly different. And it, this is a hint at something that I was, or that's a general rule. Here what I said is what you can show is I gave you this object, and if you multiply, I lied to you. Oh, dear. I introduced an object here that I didn't define. But what I said is that given the Lorentz boost that we wrote on the board before, we can multiply by these two objects, and you'll produce that matrix over there. I gave this object a new name and said that it was the same lambda, but I've rearranged the indices slightly. The one thing that I did here that I lied, or I should have noted, is that I used the idea of the inverse of eta. So one might have written this object, and what I want it to be is something that when I contract it, that again, that just gives me a delta function, but what you can check is that this object, or rather than writing that inverse there, the notation, well, we'll call it a definition, is just to write eta alpha beta, and in fact, in the simple case that we're working with here, that object is the same, this matrix is the same matrix as here, but when I'm writing these equations with the summation notation, it's important to keep track of whether or not I'm writing this matrix or that matrix, even though the entries are the same. The other thing we had before, for instance, or an example, was we had the wave vector contracted with the x vector, and I said that that was an invariant object. But what that hints at then, or what that suggests, is I can build, given a contravariant vector, I can build a covariant vector simply by contracting with our matrix, or our metric. So we can call this object k alpha with eta alpha beta the covariant vector k beta. Or in other words, I can raise and lower indices with eta alpha beta and the inverse here. And that's what this notation was. I've taken lambda and I've raised and lowered, I've lowered the first index and raised the second index.
Is there a problem in your expression? Like there are three alphas.
Yeah, yeah.
Run that.
Yes, there is.
Okay, I'm sorry. So we can use the inverse to but But we should note that it matters whether the object I'm talking about has raised or lowered indices. Remember that k alpha was equal to omega over c and then a k vector or a wave vector. But when I lower the indices, because of that, the time-time component or the zero-zero component has a minus sign. So when I lower the indices, there's an extra minus sign that appears in the zero component with the index of indices down. And then the last thing before a break is just to suggest, well, what I said before, or what's hinted at here, is that we're, as well as vectors, in general, we're going to run into, or one can run into objects with lots of indices. So I might have a whole bunch here, like that. Implicitly, then, when I'm doing my Lorentz transformations, each of these indices transforms with the lambda, and each of these transforms with the lambda inverse. And in inner products, these can be contracted with contravariant vectors. These can be contracted with covariant vectors, or objects with lowered indices, or objects with raised indices. An example, then, that we may have seen is the electromagnetic field strength. So if we haven't seen it, it's not that important. But there is an object that is an antisymmetric two-index tensor. It's actually defined in terms of a four potential, which we'll run, or you're invited to investigate in the problem set. But it's an object like this, and that captures all of the usual, Maxwell's equations can be written in terms of this. The components here are comprised of the things we usually think of as the magnetic and electric fields. If I upset the symmetry or the anti-symmetry by raising one of these indices, I can build an object like that. And then under Lorentz transformations, I would say that f prime alpha beta, this needs a lambda, so there's an alpha gamma. Gamma, and then I need an inverse, or I can write it on the other side, beta delta. So this is just an example of, and so here's an object, it's got more than one index, and the transformation law, how I'd move from frame to frame if I wanted to work with that particular object. And so I guess basically the idea here was that we've introduced this idea of four vectors or objects with indices which now run over time as well as space, and this handy summation notation, and in particular the use of the metric. But that's a good place to take a break, I guess. Or I can pause and answer any questions if there are questions first.
If not, why don't we take a break?